I suspect many of us have had impossible demands put upon us or have felt that. But I also have another thought. Have you ever noticed that when things finally start moving smoothly in the right direction, something can come along and derail things very quickly? Now, you can probably be thinking of a lot of different circumstances. We've certainly seen that with the recent pandemic. A year ago, we were kind of floating along, feeling like things were going pretty well, and the economy was rolling along, and it looked like the political situation had some hopeful direction to it. And then the pandemic hit, and pretty much everything came to a screeching and stunning halt in many ways, and we are still dealing with the effects of that and trying to make sense of it. And things have, you know, just gone in different ways than we would have ever hoped, for sure, let alone expected. And for some to use the designation, the apple cart has been turned over, is an understatement. You know, it's just been a wild, wild time. But I think about the friends of Daniel and Daniel himself and their experience. There was a sense in which they were hopeful. Things were moving along. They had been ripped from their homes and moved to a different place, but they found themselves having gone through this training, and now they have some good positions in their new government area, and it looked like things were finally getting off of that rough ground they were on and the uncertainty, and they had some positions, good jobs with some status in this new land, and so they likely were feeling like things were moving in a good direction, and there was some stability, there was some continuity. They felt like maybe things would be okay. And, you know, they started thinking about serving in the capacity of their new careers and utilizing the knowledge and training that they'd gone through. And they may have been hopeful that things were going to go smoothly now. And then something comes along and they find themselves in the middle of something and they're going, what on earth is going on here? Or they may have thought, what is God doing that now our lives are threatened? But it turns out God had some bigger plans, because God was doing something that they didn't know about, that they were going to find out about in short order. So it brings to mind the reality that God has his purposes and his plans, and that sometimes includes an element of pressure being put on us because God is moving in a particular way, in a particular direction, and we are being stretched and we need to be prepared to handle that. And the question is, are we prepared to be stretched with the external pressure that's on us? And we find ourselves in situations where we're wondering, can it get any worse? And then something else comes along and you wonder, can it get any worse? And then something else comes along and you wonder, can it get any worse? And is it ever going to get better? And that's kind of what we have been feeling to some degree. So let's think about the context of the passage that we're going to be looking at today in Daniel chapter 2. After having been exposed to the situation of the four young men having been taken from Judah and by the Babylonians, and now find themselves having been trained in this position and then being given responsibilities. So we want to think about the background to an unusual demand. And looking at Daniel chapter 2, verses 1 through 3, we read, "Now in the second year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams, and his spirit was so troubled that his sleep left him." You ever been there? I suspect many have. "Then the king gave the command to call the magicians, the astrologers, the sorcerers, and the Chaldeans to tell the king his dreams. So they came and stood before the king, and the king said to them, I have had a dream, and my spirit is anxious to know the dream. So to start with, we recognize that there was a desperate concern for answers on the part of the king. He wanted to know what is going on. And then the chapter begins with another chronological reference, which we saw in the previous chapter. It began with a chronological reference, and it ended with one as well, which kind of contextualizes things a little bit. So the events related in this chapter happened in the second year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign. But according to several reliable scholars, Nebuchadnezzar officially became king on September 7, 605 BC. So if you've got your chronological thinking going on, you might want to try to make some sense of it. On the 1st of Nisan, 604 BC, the following spring, the first official year of his reign began, because we said there was a differentiation here. The intervening months constituted his accession year and were credited to his father. I was thinking it was Nabonidus, although I'm trying to remember if I'm correct on that. The first year of his reign then ended on the 1st of Nisan the following year, 603 BC. The second year of his reign began in 603 and ended in 602 BC. And then Daniel and his friends, their training must have been completed about this time, since they were in the king's service by this time. And they may or may not have been completely finished, but it could be that they had already finished within that time frame. And then we see that the king had a recurring and troubling dream. The Hebrew of verse 1 says that the Nebuchadnezzar had dreamed dreams that disturbed him. Eventually, he had a recurring dream or a similar dream or dreams that he later described as one dream, because it apparently was basically the same thing. And then these dreams were such that they robbed him of his rest, and that was not an unusual thing, because we had seen that with Pharaoh when he had dreams, Genesis chapter 41, or Ahasuerus and Esther 6 also had dreams that brought some disturbance, and perhaps many of us have had as well, of a similar kind of nature. But these were not just normal kinds of dreams. Now, I don't know how many of you have had a dream and you woke up in the morning and you told the next nearest person you came to, what was my dream and what does it mean? I don't recommend trying that. It's not going to go very far. But sometimes we can at least relate to the concern that was communicated here. So all of these Gentile rulers, as we've just referenced, had suffered from some kind of insomnia, but it was part of God's dealing with them. It was what God was accomplishing with them, and something that needed to be communicated, because it had to do with things that were going to be taking place in the future. So the people of that day, and probably many today as well, would think about dreams as having significance that would relate to events or things that are to come. And you don't want to get too far into that, or you're going to end up with Stranger Things. I mean, they have said, have you not heard, that schizophrenia is basically living out your dreams. So if you start living out your dreams, you might want to get checked out. Just a thought. So evidently, God chose this leader, that is Nebuchadnezzar, for this dream because it was Nebuchadnezzar who had terminated the Israelites' theocracy as, you know, being God's people in God's land, and began the times of the Gentiles that are mentioned in Luke 21:24. And so because of this concern about the dreams, the king assembled the most respected experts in this field. So there were particular people that should have some idea of how to deal with these kinds of things. And so he wanted the correct interpretation of what he had dreamed. He wanted to make sure that somebody could help him. So he just called on everybody. He said, all right, all hands on deck. Everybody get out here. Tell me what's going on. So there are four distinct groups that are identified here. The magicians were evidently scholars who could divine the future by using various means. The astrologers that are referenced, or conjurers or enchanters, could evidently communicate with the dead. And we know what Saul tried to do with Samuel in that regard. And we saw from that text that it was an unusual thing if it actually happened that one could do that, because only God would have the wherewithal to bring that to reality. The sorcerers practiced sorcery and cast spells, and the Chaldeans, with somewhat of a technical term here, also a form of astrologers, that referred to a priestly group that studied the heavens to determine the future. And records indicate that they were fairly accurate very often. So Daniel's now preparing his readers, as he's recording this for us, for the failure of these individuals, these king's counselors, that's going to follow by pointing out that there were many different groups of them, that they had brought out, took out all the stops, just brought everybody in that they could think of. And so this was a consultation of the brightest and the best of the kingdom. They were the elite professionals of the day. Now, think for a moment. Who are our elite professionals of the day? Are they much different than the magicians and conjurers and astrologers and prognosticators and all the rest? Maybe there's a parallel. I wouldn't necessarily put weathermen in the same category, but that's close. You could argue on that, and some have referred to themselves in that way, but usually as a joke. But as I think about our elite professionals of our day, I don't think they have the answers either. As a matter of fact, very often they're leading us in the wrong direction, and may not be much different than these conjurers in some sense, because of all the confusion and the contradiction and all of that we see. So we want to, again, come back. What does the Lord say? What does the Bible say? Not just what do the people out there who are supposedly the experts say. Some actually are in their field, and some may not be quite so much. Then looking at Daniel 2, verses 4 through 6, we read, "Then the Chaldeans spoke to the king in Aramaic." And from here on through, I think, chapter 7, it's in Aramaic. "O king, live forever. Tell your servants the dream, and we will give you the interpretation." The king answered and said to the Chaldeans, "My decision is firm. If you do not make known the dream to me and its interpretation, you shall be cut in pieces, and your houses shall be made an ash heap." That sounds pretty serious. "However, if you tell the dream and its interpretation, you shall receive from me gifts, rewards, and great honor. Therefore, tell me the dream and its interpretation. Are you left with any wonderment as to what he wanted?" Pretty clear. There's no question. The designated consequences for responses. What was desired? Well, the experts, the conjurers, etc., requested reasonable information. The Chaldeans took the lead here, it seems to be in the response, in replying to the king, and they responded in the Aramaic language, which was widely used for business and government throughout the empire. They began with the usual formalities. "Live forever." Now, quite frankly, I cannot imagine in our day using that term for our leaders. There are way too many of them that we do not want to live forever, at least not in office. That's why we have term limits. There's enough. We don't need that because we recognize their fallibility. So fortunately, we have not carried on that language for really good reasons. We have enough of a nightmare of what we're dealing with that we wouldn't want to perpetuate it indefinitely. But what they're indicating is something of their limits, the limits of their skills and their practice. They could not come up with the dream itself. And the king seemed to be perhaps testing them. It's a little bit difficult to tell for sure, depending on which verse you look at, as to whether the king knew what the dream was or he didn't remember what the dream was, and he needed them to tell him, or he was testing them to see if they were for real. So it's not entirely clear on that. The king's demands were decisive and clear. You tell me the dream and the interpretation. Failure to do so will result in execution, and probably untidy execution and destruction. Success will result in gifts, rewards, and great honor. There was no margin. This was an all or nothing. You come through, or it's literally do or die. Tell the dream or else you die. And everybody in this group, these four groups that are listed here, are in the same boat. There's no exceptions. So one of the things that I think we can observe here is the danger of having too much power in one person. The king can take life at his will for whatever reason that happens to come to him. And we know that in our own society, in looking at history, whenever someone takes too much power and it goes in a direction that is unhelpful and usually results in very serious damage to others in the process. So without mentioning any names, you can see some parallels can happen when you are dealing with some sort of tyrannical kind of rule. And so it's an expectation. You bend to the whim of the ruler no matter what. And I think it can be a dangerous situation. And we are all too aware of that kind of thing. Then moving on, the peril of the most capable men. Looking at verses 8 or 7 through 9, we read, "They answered again and said, 'Let the king tell his servants the dream, and we will give its interpretation.' The king answered and said, 'I know for certain that you would gain time because you see that my decision is firm. If you do not make known the dream to me, there is only one decree for you. For you have agreed to speak lying and corrupt words before me till the time has changed.'" In other words, you're just trying to come up with things to pacify me, and your time is limited. "Therefore, tell me the dream, and I shall know that you can give me its interpretation." So that sounds like a rather tense moment in the lives of those people who are dealing with this king. The rejection of a plea for reasonableness. The wise men repeated their urgent request. The repetition of the wise men's request, sort of reinforcement. In Scripture, often when things are repeated, it's done so to indicate the certainty of it. And Joseph makes that clear in dealing with the dream of the baker and the butler in Genesis 41. And there are times when something is repeated that indicates this is for sure, this is for real. And that kind of emphasis sort of points out the seriousness of it and the concern that would be on the part of of these individuals that were the officials of the king in this regard. So their request and their denial essentially sealed their fate, that they were not able to provide what the king wanted. And so the king, in order to save face for himself, would have to follow through on what he said. And that meant this was very serious for them. The king's intent and rationale for denial, why did he do this? Well, the king saw through the wise men's pleas as an attempt to delay the inevitable and perhaps to put distance between the dream and its interpretation. They may have hoped that as time passed, he would forget what he had dreamed, and if he had not done so already, and they may not have been sure about that either. And perhaps his expectations of them would diminish over time, that maybe he'd kind of lighten up a little bit and realize that this is a little bit over the top. But he seemed to want a guarantee that he was going to get the right interpretation. If he knew the dream or if he couldn't remember the dream, then he needed to have it in order to find out what it meant. What was the significance anyway? So he wanted also to be sure that they would have a correct and accurate and were not just making something up. What would they have normally done? They would have made their best guess. I think, maybe, perhaps, this was what this dream means. On a good day, they might be able to come up with that. And some have suggested that he was actually testing these wise men. So because Nebuchadnezzar would have been probably younger than many of them and may have wanted an excuse to eliminate these people because of the associated continuity with his father, kind of like Rehoboam did when he had his counselors and he didn't follow the ones that had been part of Solomon's group. And he wanted to bring his own cronies in, which that kind of thing has happened before, and sort of wanted to start over. And this would give him an excuse to get rid of them. And maybe there was something to that. And he may have been questioning their legitimacy. Maybe he actually thought that people can't do what they say they can do. And he was testing them. He wanted to find out, are they really honest? Are they really sincere? Are they really capable? And the Chaldeans actually had developed dream manuals where they systematically arranged the different ways of responding to the dreams that people would have had. And they had an extensive amount of material on this in order to cover any possible eventualities that might come up so that they would know how to deal with a dream when someone had one. And even so, it's still a matter of a best guess. So they were at a difficult spot. A lot of pressure. I mean, like, total pressure. Then looking at chapter 2, verses 10 through 11, the Chaldeans answered the king and said, "There is not a man on earth who can tell the king's matter. Therefore, no king, lord, or ruler has ever asked such things of any magician, astrologer, or Chaldean. It is a difficult thing that the king requests, and there is no other who can tell it to the king except the gods whose dwelling is not with flesh." Whoa, there's an admission. We can't do it. We don't have what it takes. They are in a very difficult spot of recognizing their limitations, and it's really preparatory for what's coming. The desperate reasoning of imperiled men. The Chaldeans explained that this request was humanly impossible, which was a good thing in anticipation of what we know is going to happen, but who knew what was going to happen at this point? We can look back. They didn't know. So they were trying to be courteous and offer some flattery to the king throughout the process, but they were also being very realistic and saying, this has never been asked before. This is something that can't be done. Although they were in the position of indicating, for all intents and purposes, that they could do such things. They probably at this point wanted to say, King, you are crazy. But that would not go well. They were already on very shaky ground. And so it's a reminder that we are not the first to complain about our leaders' demands. They indicated that only a god could provide such information. They were not gods, and they could not gain this information from the gods. They didn't have the wherewithal that they had indicated that they were able to do it, because that was precisely what they had claimed to be able to do, to provide supernatural information. So their confession, in essence, set the stage for Daniel's ability to do precisely what they said no person could do, and it was preparatory for what God was going to do. Kind of reminds you of the Israelites when God was calling Moses to take them out of Egypt, and God was going to show that there's no way except for divine provision to get them out of there. And that's what happened. And that's the case here as well. God has a way of doing that. Puts us in a place where we have no way out unless we trust Him. And when we find ourselves in the situations that we are finding ourselves in today, we may feel that we're in a similar position. And we need to recognize, well, God can still come up with stuff that we never dreamed of. So don't give up hope. Then looking at verses 12 and 13. For this reason, the king was angry and very furious and gave the command to destroy all the wise men of Babylon. So the decree went out, and they began killing the wise men, and they sought Daniel and his companions to kill them. Now, that's kind of a frightening scenario. We have seen throughout history occasions where incredibly horrible things have been done because someone decided this is what we ought to do. And this is one of those occasions. And so it's not surprising when we see things around us that are happening where someone decides we're going to do this, this, and this, and we think, that is a very bad thing to do. Why are we doing that? And they just decide that's what they want to do. Somebody has to pick up the pieces. The irrational command of an obsessed ruler. The king commanded that all of his wise men be killed. Their confession of their inability and their complaint that the king was essentially being unfair with them did not go well. It didn't end well for them. Because people in power don't like their authority or their judgment questioned. We've seen that before. And so he gave orders to execute all the wise men in Babylon, specifically those who were his counselors. And we had a delineation of who was included in that. And of course, that was a rather radical order, and it had obviously dire consequences. Not only would people die, but wouldn't the resources that had been there for the king's benefit also be lost for no good reason? I mean, you don't just get rid of a huge number of people, don't know exactly how many, but by the listing of the name or the numbers, the kinds of groups here, probably would have been some significant number. Was it in fact a purging? Or was it just his obsessive response that was part of the equation? But fortunately, it didn't happen all at once. The carrying out of the command took time. And so likely, it's at least been suggested, that the scope of the killing was focused on the city of Babylon as opposed to the entire province, because it would have had to do with those who were the king's counselors who would have had some proximity to him. Not just sure how that would have been worked out in reality, but that seems to be the impression. And it seems as if Daniel and his friends were not immediately close, so there was some going out to find them. And so they also fell under this edict because they were advisors to the king, not necessarily because they were practicing the same things that these other individuals were doing. And so God was also obviously at work to protect Daniel and his friends so that they were not the first ones to be sought out. Because obviously it sounds like from reading the text that there were some that were already killed by this point. But it is amazing to see how much damage can be done by an obsessive ruler's mandates and edicts. And there have been many that have not fared well throughout history. And there are often many unintended consequences, and we have seen those, and we know what that can be like. And it obviously brings up some concern. But what do we do in a situation like that? Are we completely helpless? In some ways, we may feel that way, but if God is still in control, maybe it's not hopeless, and we need to be encouraged by that. The supernatural provision for a difficult request. There is still the reality of God's provision. Verses 14 through 16 we read, "Then with counsel and wisdom Daniel answered Arioch, the captain of the king's guard, who had gone out to kill the wise men of Babylon. He answered and said to Arioch, the king's captain, 'Why is the decree from the king so urgent?' Then Arioch made the decision known to Daniel," explained what was going on. "So Daniel went in and asked the king to give him time that he might tell the king the interpretation." So apparently Daniel had enough connection, clout, whatever, with Arioch to be able to gain audience with the king. There was a special request for time to respond. And Daniel respectfully questioned the urgency of the command. When Daniel became aware of the circumstances, he approached someone through whom he could get some answers. And he followed the protocol to find the way to get the right response and to get to the right person. And so there was value in him maintaining some level of rapport so that he's not automatically executed because he is questioning something that comes along. So as was the case with Joseph, we see also with Daniel that he finds himself with those of high authority, and he's able to maintain some connection with them because of having had good rapport with them, because he has been diligent in following those things that the Lord has communicated to him. So there's some value in that as well. Daniel respectfully requested more time to respond. He was working within the parameters that he had to work with, which we ought to do as well. We, because of our makeup of our government, we have means by which we can have impact. Sometimes it seems like we are not given much attention, but we still need to let it be known where we are coming from on as many matters as we can. And so we need to recognize and take advantage of that as well. And so Daniel could have what I would call freaked out when he found out the circumstances, but he didn't. He maintained his composure. He worked through the proper channels, and he trusted the Lord throughout all of this. He wasn't relying on strictly his own abilities. He wasn't relying on any dependability of the king himself, but he was seeking to trust the Lord, but to follow as reasonably as possible the means by which he could have some impact for good and we obviously would want to do the same as well. Can we maintain our composure when the pressure is on us? Can we stay calm in a very difficult situation and not panic? That's a good question. Then verses 17 and 18, then Daniel went to his house and made the decision known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, his companions, that they might seek mercies from God, from the God of heaven concerning this secret. That is, they wanted to find out what was this dream, so that Daniel and his companions might not perish with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. There was a special devotion to focused prayer. Well, that's certainly a good reminder for us, a good place to go when the pressure is on. Where do you turn? Turn to the Lord. Is that the first thought that comes to our mind? Or do we think, oh, if we just do the right political moves, everything will be fine? Well, maybe not so. Start with prayer and then work through the details from there, perhaps. Daniel informed his three friends of the situation so they could pray together about it. It's actually one of the first instances of united prayer recorded in Scripture, where they had that specific focus and intention. And so this indicates something of the significance of their walk with the Lord, their dependence upon Him, even in captivity, even away from their people. They recognize the need to depend on the Lord. And maybe it's when we're in those difficult situations that this realization comes out more than ever. And perhaps in our own situation today, nationally, that is the case, because we recognize there isn't anything we can do. We need to pray. And that's a good reminder. Since the decree affected them all, they joined together in this time of corporate prayer to the God of heavens, is what it literally says. And this title is used five times in this chapter, in verse 18, 19, 28, 37, and 44, plus a few other places. And usually in books where the pagan Babylon is the setting. It's also in Daniel 5:23, and end up being used nine times in Ezra, four times in Nehemiah, and also in a couple of other passages. The Babylonians worshipped the heavens, but Yahweh is the God of over all the heavens. He's above and beyond, not just the God of heaven. So He is the ruler over all, and that's, again, part of the emphasis that's brought out in the book of Daniel, is God's supremacy. And they prayed for mercy from God due to this harsh edict. They sought the compassion of the Lord. They recognized their difficult situation, the need that they had, a seeking of this dream so that they might be able to provide it for the king. And that's what they were, again, looking to, the Lord's provision of something that was something they couldn't come up with. And there are times when we can't come up with things on our own, and we need to look to the Lord as well. Good reminder. And then verses 19, starting with verse 19, then the secret was revealed to Daniel in a night vision. So Daniel blessed the God of heaven. And then continuing verses 20 to 22, Daniel answered and said, blessed be the name of God forever and ever, for wisdom and might are His. And He changes the times and the seasons. He removes kings and raises up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. He reveals deep and secret things. He knows what is in the darkness, and light dwells with Him. Covers a lot of ground there. And then verse 23, I thank You and praise You, O God of our fathers. You have given me wisdom and might, and have made known to me what we asked of You. For You have made known to us the king's demand. So obviously very timely, a time of great pressure. The Lord provides what is needed. Does the Lord always provide what we pray for? No. He provides what is consistent with what he wants to see come to pass. And if we are seeking his will, we will recognize the significance of that. There was a divine provision for the unusual demand. The answer to the prayer came in a night vision. What's recorded here is these events are an indication of God revealing things in his time and in his way. And this vision came at night, as a night vision rather than a dream. In a vision, the person receives the revelation while they're awake, but in a dream, it's while they're asleep. So that's basically the difference there. Both methods were used in Scripture as vehicles of communicating divine revelation. The specific details of the vision are revealed later, as we'll be looking at shortly. But the intention here is to focus on the responses to the receiving of the revelation. And here we see that Daniel responds with a litany of praise and thanksgiving. And it's really an indication of all that God is able to do and the need to simply recognize his provision. And reference to his name, again, is an indication of something regarding his nature or the character of God, often used as a synonym for him. And it's true in the Old Testament and the New Testament. They both use the name in that sense. But it's focusing on this is what God is like. This is what God is able to do, and we need to trust him in that. Evidence of God's power is his control of events and nations, and that's part of what is communicated here. It includes the times and the seasons. He determines when in history events will happen and how long each process or phase of history will last. In terms of the major events of history, does that mean he micromanages all the individual details? He utilizes people according to their choices as well. Evidence of his power to control the destiny of nations relates to the reality that he sets up kings and deposes them. God puts things in place. Again, not micromanaging, but working through people and their personalities and their choices. God is big enough that he can do that, which is amazing. Daniel identified two evidences of God's wisdom. He gives wisdom to the wise as the source of all wisdom. He reveals things that would be unknown to humans otherwise. And he can do this because he knows what is unknown, that things that people don't know. And he provides the light of knowledge to those that he desires. He recognized that God made known what was demanded by the king and saved their lives. He gave credit to the proper source for the wisdom and the power that was available to him to be able to deal with this dream that was requested, so that he could have not only a knowledge of what the dream is, but also what it meant. And that we'll be looking at that next time. So he was trusting the Lord. He was seeking the Lord. The Lord provided. And the Lord is the originator of the revelations. It wasn't that Daniel was so smart. It was that Daniel was the instrument through whom God was going to communicate in this particular way. And he was confident that the information that God was going to give him would save their lives. And it's, again, it's an acknowledgement of the supernatural work that is being done on this occasion. And so we are urged and reminded to trust the Lord in those difficult times as well. So when we are faced with impossible demands, this may be at least an example of a way to handle it. What do you do in those difficult situations? What was the first thing they did? Find out, okay, what's really going on here? And then let's go to the Lord in prayer. And that's what was done. And that's a good reminder of what we can do as well. And the Lord will answer according to the need of the situation in His way. So there's an element of being as courteous as one can be in the face of the opposition and trusting the Lord implicitly, completely, all the time, all the way. So we have that same privilege and resource, and we need to do that. And we need to thank the Lord for the fact that He is who He is. He is the one who provides what we need. And one of the needs that we have, of course, is salvation. And the Lord provides that for us as well. And we can trust Him for that. And so we want to do so on a personal basis. And we want to be thankful for the Lord, as Daniel was thankful for the provision that was made.